Welcome, everyone, to episode 112 of the New Gen Mindset Podcast. I'm Dan Cozell here with Nick Tartaglia. We had a pretty interesting weekend, to say the least.
Yeah.
We know what's going on in the Middle East. I mean, we've been calling for this escalation since it really started. And the other thing that I would say, too, is if Iran really wanted to send a message to the United States, they probably would have done it when the market was open. So to me, that's probably just a blimp in the sky for now, but I don't think that whole area is finished. There's a lot more that's coming. So yeah, markets sold off yesterday midday, which was pretty not surprising. Silver actually rejected the $30 mark really aggressively. So another buying opportunity. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I mean, at the same time, it's like if we think about this Middle Eastern conflict, it's only going to add a lot of like pressure on the energy industry, especially as the military conflict around the world continues. So this, you know, it's kind of relevant to the subject we're going to talk about today. Well, at least one of the subjects, but in the sense that energy is becoming something that appears to become more scarce or more complicated to get our hands on. And the more complicated that industry becomes, the more people are going to have to start playing games to ensure access to certain resources for energy. And the game of energy is about to escalate. You know, we just had them, at the LME just end up banning what nickel, aluminum, and what was the other one from Russia? One other metal. They had banned three, basically banning all the exports or importations from Russia. So you know there's a battle of resources that is escalating around the world. And obviously this, the Middle East has a huge impact on oil and the energy world. So it's definitely a subject or a matter to keep an eye on.
A lot of moving parts, to say the least. We're watching it pretty closely. And, you know, I think people really just need to start preparing for this stuff right now. But there are a lot of good energy companies out in Canada that are doing really well. So we're not going to talk about that too much right now. What we are going to do is we're going to bring on a special guest here who started off as a successful career in the education sector. She was teaching English as a foreign language to over 20,000 students overseas. And now what she's done is she's taken her wealth of knowledge and her passion for junior mining and really branching out and just sharing her ideas about what she's looking at and what else is out there. And she is the official founder of the Next Big Rush newsletter. We want to welcome to the New Gen Mindset podcast, Fabi Lara.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here.
So good to see you again, by the way. It's been last time we saw you was in Vancouver. So hopefully things are going well for you.
Yes, things are going very well. Thanks for asking. I'm looking out my window here and it's bright and sunny and awesome. So after this, I might head out.
not a luxury we really have in Canada yet, you know? So it's just
exactly. I try to rub it in, you know, as often as I can. It's one of the perks of living in Portugal.
Of course. So Fabi, give us a little backstory to your career. You know, what brought you into the mining world and, you know, what made you want to create the platform that you did?
Right. So in short, failure brought me into the mining world, and it brought me into it twice, I guess, because what happened is way back in 2011, as I was, you know, just operating my business, I started to watch some interesting videos online. I've always had this sort of interest in what's out there investment-wise, speculation-wise, what else can we do with, you know, the little bit of money that's left over at the end of the month. And so I was on YouTube and I started to look at all these silver investing videos at the time. So this was 2010, I guess, when it started. And as I started to get educated about the thesis in and of itself, I started to buy, you know, physical coins and things of that nature. And so not realizing where we were in the cycle, I bought it all the way up 2010, 2011 to the top and then just held, right? I was dollar cost averaging up, but not down. And then what happened is it started to slid down and then down and then down and then down. And then I noticed, like, you know, something is off. I mean, a lot of what I've learned is fact, verifiable fact, but there's something off about the timing that I use to make my investment decisions. And so from that, I was like, okay, so what can we learn from this? And I started to learn a little bit more about mining because I kept hearing that the leverage was in the mining stocks, the silver and gold mining stocks. And I started to look into, what they were, how they were different, what made a producer different to an explorer, to a developer, et cetera. And then I started to dabble. And that's when things started to really work because I then caught a better time in the market by the time that I really started looking more seriously, towards these stocks. It was, 2014. And so 2014 was, a really good time. It was a really good time to get in cheap because nobody cared about gold and silver. It was somewhat of a similar situation as to what we lived, I would say, in 2023, sentiment-wise. The price was steady enough that it should have gained more interest. It should have attracted more interest. And it didn't. It was kind of, no man's land. And then I understood that I was decent enough at buying stuff that nobody else cared about and holding, and just looking at it and just trying to better understand it. And then as long as the company isn't out there, diluting themselves into nothingness and not making things worse, then things got better. And then when things got better, I'm like, oh, okay, I kind of like this game. And then when you make your first, three, five bagger or whatever, then you're kind of hooked from then onwards. And so what made me actually, start investing in mining stocks was my failure in buying silver and gold and holding it and thinking that, I was buying it at a good time and then getting the timing right the second time around. And then what made me actually, take this a little bit more seriously and do it from a professional standpoint is I was invited, to speak and people really understood my point of view from an investor's perspective, right? Because yes, I'm technically a newsletter writer. And I do look at a lot of companies. I summarize every day what happened in the mining world. And I try to take the very best headlines and put it in email format, short and sweet for people to digest it and then, do their own due diligence as they see fit. But what happened was I just positioned myself in a way that kind of made me early to trends. And so I think that people started to see that I was usually early to trends that were just starting to develop that turned out to be right. So, I was early to the uranium trade. I started, investing in uranium companies in 2014 and 2018 more heavily. And now look at, where uranium has gone. Kind of don't want to talk about my Bitcoin story because it's so painful, but I was investing in Bitcoin in 2011. Before it even hit $5, per Bitcoin. And so I started to see, a pattern that I was connected enough and on top of things enough that I could see trends early. And so because I could see trends early, people started to listen to what I had to say, which I guess is why they're still listening to me. So yeah, that's the really long version of it.
You really are a contrarian at heart, which is like, I thought Nick and I mean, I'll speak for myself, but I thought I was a contrarian. When Bitcoin was where it was at like 10 years ago, I was just like, I was scared to even touch it. But then 2017 happened. And I was just like, there's something going on here. People were hating on it at one point. I was like, let me just dabble in this. Obviously you get impatient, but so I'm just curious, like, where does that, because it's a very unique form of curiosity. Like, people that are contrarian, they don't think the same way that the masses normally do. So like, does that stem from something when you were maybe like younger or something that happened previously where you're just like, this is who I am?
I can't really put my finger on it, but it's funny you should say that. I'm sure it does have something to do with personality to a certain extent, because this very strange phenomena happened in church just last Sunday, and I got to tell you about it because the way it happened was so much like investing. And I know it's weird to draw a parallel from church, but this is
No,
what
of
happened.
course.
I go to a really modern church where like people like to like sing like modern music and dance around, right? And so people are like dancing around and jumping up and down. There's lots of like young people. And for some reason, I was out front where usually the younger people are. And I am very pregnant, so I'm 8 months pregnant. And there is this one time when everybody like literally gets low on the ground, because then they're gonna jump when the music goes back on. And like everybody is, getting down, and I'm just standing there, and I am literally in the middle of everybody, and I'm just standing there. First of all, I think I didn't used to do this before I was pregnant because I have a back problem. So no, that's not for me. But now that I'm pregnant, it's a double no. So I'm just gonna stand here. And like I looked around, there were like old people, young people, people that looked like they really couldn't get back up, and they were all low on the ground because they didn't want to be the one person standing up. But then what happened is I started to feel like, oh my gosh, here we go again. I'm gonna have to like pretend, I'm getting low on the ground. And then I'm like, no, I'm not gonna do it. And I'm just gonna stand here. I'm gonna pose for the camera. I'm gonna smile, and it's gonna be awesome. So I'm gonna like swing this back in my favor so that I stand out, because I don't have to be like the other people, right? And so I think that at some point, likely in childhood, in early years, something happened where, being different was actually what I had going for me. It might have been the fact that, my family moved from Brazil when I was about 10 years of age. We moved to Wales in the UK, out of all places. And I had to learn English by just being in a classroom full of people who didn't speak my language. And so me being different made me special. And I couldn't have been, afraid to stand out too much, because that was part of what it brought to the table. I knew from the beginning I was never going to be like the other kids. And so obviously learned the language to a certain extent. And I was able to culturally connect to, what was going on. But at the same time, I've always understood that I was different.
It's interesting because like the concept of evolving and adapting to new environments, I would say that's very much of a contrarian philosophical characteristic, because the whole point of being a contrarian is trying to foreshadow things that are heading your way so you can be malleable and adaptable to whatever's happening or whatever's occurring. And I think it's really just, in a way, macro, or just trying to foresee things, or just trying to be prepared, just trying to make sure that whatever comes your way, it doesn't slap you in the face and you get blindsided by it. So that contrarian philosophy seems to me to be like more of a macro mindset rather than a micro mindset. You're not stuck within a little vacuum or a little bubble. You want to be exposed to new ideas and new world developments so that you can evolve and, flow like the water, as Bruce Lee says, with whatever's happening in the world. And that really appears, I think, to be much more of that, the contrarian perspective.
I agree with that, and I think that there are also different levels of contrarian thinking.
Fair enough.
So I wouldn't be the one to be the first person to point something out and say, hey, this is where the world is going next. I need to have some sort of semi-authoritative voice to give clues into what might be next, and then I can, sniff it out by myself, and then decide whether to, be a contrarian because I'm early enough, but not be a complete contrarian where I'm a lone wolf and a lone voice in the wilderness. I was actually talking about this last January, because I brought up the fact that within the mining industry, there is a very almost right-wing or libertarian way of thinking about the world and the economy specifically, which made us all kind of into cheerleaders against the Fed. And then from that way of thinking, everybody expected, you know, a big dip in the economy, especially in the US. And because of that, a lot of the people within the mining industry weren't getting into copper. And this was just the ongoing conversation that I was having with most people, like, oh yeah, copper. I'm bullish copper long term, but short term, nobody owned it. And then I'm like, huh, this is kind of strange, you know, because if we aren't buying copper companies, it must mean that they're by definition cheap because nobody else cares about copper companies. So yeah, and I started to talk about copper in January. And you know, I right now only have one position in copper in one specific company, but I'm looking to get into more. And the price of copper has done really, really well. And you know, some of these companies are starting to catch a bid now because, you know, I was contrarian within the contrarian industry. And so yeah, there's different levels to that. So you gotta just know one, your level of experience in your industry to see how much of a contrarian you can be. But yeah, it usually pays off as long as you're getting in on a trend that isn't, you know, past, I don't know, halfway or two thirds of the way, then being a contrarian is really worth it.
It goes heavily with, yeah, go down.
No, I was just going to say, like, it's true because copper has just been bouncing for the last 5 years. It just hasn't broken out. And then finally it happened this year, which makes sense because you're seeing really structural supply globally be cut short to a T. So I guess it's fair to say that you really saw that earlier on too. And that's usually a time where everyone thinks you're crazy, right?
Yeah. And that's one of my only edges, really. I still don't, you know, I don't consider myself a mining expert per se. I'm definitely not a geo expert. I don't know anything about engineering. I don't know how people get stuff out of the rock. I know that they do, but I couldn't explain to you the different processes and what could go wrong with a mine and why in some places in the world, you know, the metallurgy working out to be like this or like that is better or worse. I don't know. But I do know when people have dropped a commodity altogether and it's completely off, you know, off the radar, and how looking at, you know, just basic numbers of supply and demand, you know, you can usually draw conclusions from where you think the world is going, what you see people buying or not buying, different demographic trends, et cetera. And a lot can be done and gain from, you know, just getting better at the stuff you're already good at rather than just trying to be good at all of the different aspects of investing, speculating.
No, of course, the technical side is an entirely different game, like getting to really understand the technical and engineering. And that's a whole other game, which takes a long time, even for myself, you know, following the mining industry for a couple of years now. The geology side of it, I'm just starting to understand more. And this is probably 5 years into kind of studying and looking at mining. So I'm just starting now to pick up on these type of details that before were really hard to really contextualize what they meant and how to trickle it down to where can this potential lead as in terms of a assay or this, that.
Yeah.
So it's always a learning industry, which is what I really appreciate about this industry.
True. It's very true. And I think that you need to know the basics not to get completely fooled, but there is a point at, you know, at which you have to ask yourself, am I competing with the other geologists? Will I ever know more than they do? Probably not. And so, you know, what's my edge here? How can I use something else as my edge and not just, you know, looking at different rocks and trying to ascertain whether, you know, this is a real ore body and or just a good hit. A lot of the times we don't know. And I see a lot of geologists as well falling in love with potential and then just not realizing that, you know, maybe the people behind the project don't really want to do what it takes in order to see that potential through. And yeah, there's a lot of money to be made just by understanding who the players are and understanding how they are being benefited insiders, board members, management teams, et cetera, and not just the fundamental question of will this ever become a mine, because that's probably a 1 in 3,000 chance if you're lucky.
Who were some of the figures when you started getting into the mining industry that kind of like really opened the door or really you learned a lot from in the industry? If there are some.
So bar none, Rick Rule. I still, you know, listen to most of his stuff. He has a lot of wisdom, and I can actually pinpoint one particular thing that he said that made me find a 15 bagger. So one of my best speculation stories was when I bought Encore Energy. So this was a uranium company. I think I started buying it in, I think it was 2018, 2019, something like that. So Encore Energy was basically a company sitting on a lot of different uranium assets, mostly in the USA. And something interesting about them is that they had big names on board and advisory, but they didn't seem to be very active in doing anything. Back then, there weren't many uranium companies to begin with. But the ones that were around in general, you'd see more news flow and more activity around them. And with Encore, it's almost like, you know, it was like not active, which begged the question, why? And I remember Rick Rule distinctively saying that it was, you know, a very deep bear market for, you know, certain commodities. I don't remember if he was specifically talking about uranium, but he said, when the market is really bad, what you do is you go for the companies that are doing nothing. They're not raising. They're not exploring. They're just holding on to their assets. So they do have assets. You know, there's not greenfield exploration. This is a quote unquote development company. So they have assets in the ground that should be worth more if you believe that the commodity is going up in price eventually. And that was the thesis, because uranium was $20 per pound. And so if you believe that the price of it was going up, obviously then all of the projects would be worth more in due time. And then I remember that I was searching for information on which uranium companies were doing the least, which is exactly the opposite of what you should be doing in most normal times, right? You want news flow. You want the company to be coming out with, hey, we found this, we found that, we're doing this deal, M&A activity, et cetera. And then I watched a very short video of Bill Sheriff in really low quality. I think the camera was made out of like vegetable parts, because like you could barely see him, but you could hear him enough. And so it was like, no, there's enough uranium around the world. We're not, you know, in the business of looking for uranium. There's plenty of it to go around. We're just waiting for the price to come back up. And so until it does, we're just holding on to our assets. I'm like, that's it. That's the company. That is the one that is going to get some of my attention. And so, yeah, I bought it at a real low. And it became eventually a 15 bagger for me. And I did not need at the time to look through all of their projects and figure out if those projects were better than all the other uranium companies at the time, because the fact that their projects weren't good was what made them good. Because as the price goes up, then you increase the economics of your project by a larger margin than those projects that are already high grade and expect to be profitable. And so understanding that, that really opened my eyes to the opportunity in the cyclicality of mining stocks. And so that's after that, it's like, okay, I can't leave this industry ever again, because that was really wild. And obviously the way that Bill Sheriff and the other guys set up the company was that they didn't have the best assets to begin with, but because they didn't dilute too much at the lows, they were able to then start building the company, start changing management, building, you know, a different board, different management team as time went by, to the point where now they were the first, you know, company to go from just pure development to production in the US. And now they're producing, which is mind-boggling. Mm-hmm. At the time, you could not tell that they were going to become a producer, but they were doing the right thing at the hardest time, mm-hmm. which I think to me is a good testament of the experience of the management team, right? If they were just trying to raise money and try to dilute the company at the lows, it kind of wouldn't have mattered, because if they were in the US, it's usually lower grade, you know, and the deposits aren't really large. There is nothing they could have done to attract capital way back when. And so what they did is nothing, which I'm sure it took a lot of discipline, and it was the right thing at the right time. And I was lucky enough to catch that. So Rick Rule is definitely number one. I still listen to him quite a bit. Also, I learned a lot from Marin Katusa. I know there's a love and hate relationship with Marin Katusa for most people in the industry. But I really like his take on energy, and you know, how Putin has always tried to move the pieces around the chessboard and you know, grab the West by the you know what, mm-hmm. regarding, you know, energy policies, which turned out to be 100% right. And I just, you know, really learned a lot from him and the newsletter that he puts out. I think with newsletter writers in general, that I've learned is they have many good ideas, and you don't know which good ideas are going to turn out to be, you know, right. And so unless you're willing to buy all of their stock picks, it's better not to buy any of them. And I know some people are frustrated with, you know, some other stock pickers out there and newsletter writers and stuff like that. But that's how it works. You need to have a basket. And if you just pick the ones that you think sound the best, then, you know, you might be picking the one that's the dog out of all of them. So, yeah. And I mean, I like to look at company builders like Ross Beaty. Mm-hmm. I think he is just a really down to earth human being who is relentless at working with the very best people that he can find. And so that's another person that I like to follow as well. Somebody that I think should get a lot more airtime, but is probably, you know, so wealthy at this point that he doesn't care about, you know, doing interviews, is Bob Quartermain. And he's also just a great geological mind and can find, you know, really, really amazing things, or has found really amazing things.
The uranium story for the multibagger is fascinating, because right now, especially in this market, it's a hot gold market, it's a hot uranium market. Like, the easy money for uranium, I think, has already been made. There's still opportunity, though, I think, just because it's more of a supply issue and it's a macro issue.
Yeah.
But it's always interesting to really see what companies are out there that are blowing their budgets on, you know, any kind of promotion. They're overspending. I always like to go through the SG&As and the financial statements just to see what the salaries of some of these CEOs are during a bear market, because that is also a real indication as to how they're thinking about this business. Are you in it for yourself to try and just, you know, make ends meet, keep up your lifestyle inflation? Or are you actually in mm-hmm. it for the long haul with the shareholders? So maybe another thing that could also be encouraging, just kind of building on what you said, is like during those tough times when you see insiders buying in chunks, that's also probably a very good indication, because one, the price is very cheap. So they're just like, we know what we have, right? Yeah. The conviction is there. But yeah, I find that, and that takes a lot of honestly, it took me a few years to kind of figure that out. But once you understand it, you can really start picking out the bad apples, obviously, from the good apples. And then, you know, next thing you know, someone's writing a newsletter just promoting the hell out of a company. You probably want to take a step back a little bit and just say, okay, there's something going on here. How much, my first question is always, and I'm curious to know what your thoughts are on this, but my first question is, how many shares does the CEO have in this company?
Right. And how much did he pay for it?
Exactly.
Which is the bigger question.
The follow-up question. Yeah.
I wish I could remember who said this, because it was very, very wise. There are a few different reasons as to why an insider would sell stock. I am usually very discouraged when I do see insiders selling stock. Obviously, it depends on the company. If, for example, we're talking about Cameco, which is a multi-billion dollar company, and people who have been, you know, on the management team for, say, 5 to 10 years, and part of their, you know, part of their package is shares, you do expect them to sell. It's a different thing altogether. If it's a super tiny junior and maybe the market is expecting something from the company within the next few months, and there doesn't seem to be, you know, a good reason, like it's not tax season or whatever, then I see selling. I don't like to see that. But the truth is, there are a few different reasons as to why somebody would sell a stock. Some of them legitimate, some of them not. There's only one reason why somebody would buy the stock, and that's because they believe in it. And so I take the buys a lot more seriously and weigh them very, very heavily against, you know, what could be legitimate versus weird selling. So yeah, buying in the open market, buying private plate. Actually, now that I'm on the board of a company, when there's a private placement, we all take part, like as much as possible, right? If there's a company out there that's raising and the management team or the, you know, the board isn't participating, to me as an insider, that's a massive red flag, especially if they're drawing a salary. It's like, okay, we understand how the company is benefiting you. What is it about your own company that you can have an influence over, that you can actually add value to? How come you're not preferring your dollars into this company versus some other company that you're probably investing in? Because let's face it, you know, junior mining guys, they speculate in other junior miners, you know, like we all have a portfolio. Nobody's just here for the work. Like we like the investing game. And so when the management team doesn't participate, that to me is a massive red flag.
You know, it's interesting the story you give with Rick Rule and how it influenced your decision, because my most successful copper player was basically that thesis. They weren't trying to swim against the tide where copper prices were collapsed. They were just saying, we're going to fundamentally build our assets when everything's so cheap, and that when the tide comes back in our favor, then we'll move with the tide. And they were just buying assets. All the slight raises they were making were only driven by the directors and the insiders. They weren't opening it up to the market, and they were just buying assets pennies on the dollar.
You just said something that's so important. Okay. So a management team that really values what they have will try to do that. I don't know if it's kind of sneaky or not, but you know, they'll do small raises, but it's just them.
Exactly.
They and now see they have the value. Lundin
Group. Exactly. Yeah.
They see the value and they're like, we don't even want to open this up because we want to retain our piece of the pie. And so to me, massive green flag when that happens. Really like to see that.
So that was it. And that was one of my first picks. And it was just because of he was very much focused on how we're preparing for when the market shifts, not for how we try to prove ourselves right now where nobody cares. So obviously you're just falling on deaf ears. But if I prepare for when everybody's going to be listening, then at least and I did really well. They came back. It's normal. I sold out my position. But now it's like, you know, they have the Lundin Group now. They have Pierre Lassant in it. So they did really well. And that was from where they had nobody. So when you said that, I was like, okay, I think I fell in that ironically, because the guy who was running the company at the time, he did a great job of telling me why he was positioning himself. But it fell really within what you just said with what Rick Rule said. So
and that's it comes back to being a contrarian.
Yeah.
You take a look at it, and sometimes you buy, you think it's really cheap, and then the price goes down. You're like, my gosh, what happened? And some of these stocks have become so illiquid that literally somebody wants to, you know, sell 5-10 grand worth of stock and it goes down 10% or more. I've seen that happen before. And so it's, you have to take, you know, the price movements with a grain of salt, and not just think that there's something wrong with the company just because the price went down.
I guess with the newsletter, because that obviously the multi-bagger story is very fascinating. But when you started the newsletter, like, just walk us through what inspired you to write it the way it is right now. Because again, it's very short and to the point, and it's bite size. And I love the graphics now that you're posting on Twitter, a little bit on Instagram now, and that also is pretty helpful too. So, like, how did you get that started, essentially?
So I see every industry as an ecosystem where different players have their roles and values. And I kept thinking that something like this should exist for the junior mining industry, and especially something that was focused towards the smaller end of the market, you know, because some of the websites, I guess, that you see out there and the services that you see out there, they're talking about, you know, producers, they're talking about majors, they're talking about companies where the news is out, but, you know, 500 people have had the chance to look at that before you. And so you don't have an edge. So I kept thinking to myself, you know, there are lots and lots of news that go by every single day. And some of them don't really get picked up much. They don't get talked about until the company has, you know, a great confirmation of a discovery that was made maybe 3 weeks ago, but you missed the news release that came out 3 weeks ago. And so just for myself, I wanted there to be a summary of, you know, what happened in mining today. That's basically it. So instead of trying to go through all the different types of news and trying to sort out what was good, what was not good, and what was relevant to the small investor, I thought, okay, if one of us does this and just publishes it, then, you know, we don't all have to go through every single piece of news with a fine-tooth comb. And so I started to publish this I would say over 15 months ago. Yeah, it started early 2023. And it was just very basics. Okay, this is the price of most of the major commodities that we look at in the industry. And these are, you know, the headlines that we think are most interesting to, I guess, speculators. And that's what we do. You know, we bring out the name of the company, what they're doing, the maybe one to three lines of a highlight. And then sometimes we add in commentary of what we think of their results, or what we're questioning, or what we'd like to see next, et cetera, et cetera. So sometimes it's a company that came out with great drill results or strange drill results that, you know, would make you like question more, or that may need some context, but something that should be looked at, something that, you know, calls for attention. Or it could be M&A activity that people should know, or sometimes it's just different countries coming out with different rules, regulations, laws, et cetera, that would affect the way that you invest and you build your portfolio. So it's a mixture of those major three topics. And we try to keep it at that so that people aren't spending, you know, 2 hours a day doing that themselves.
Like, I know now you have a high, you know, kind of affiliation with uranium, at least from a market standpoint, like Jay, you know, at Jay's conference, for example, you did. Was that a design? Was that something you wanted to happen? Or was it just more of a fluke of the market kind of picking up the fact that you had a lot of good commentary about the uranium space? So, and it kind of just built your perception or your expertise in a way, or the association of you writing kind of became associated with uranium by a fluke.
Yeah, I became the uranium girl. It was complete fluke. Okay. Complete fluke. I think what did it was Twitter, because in 2018, I posted on Twitter saying that, you know, like the what happened in silver back when I started speculating in the coins in 2010, 2011, and how it completely mushroomed into this big community. Mm-hmm. I said in 2018 that that same thing was going to happen in uranium. But it was the easiest commentary to make because it was already starting to happen. Mm-hmm. And so I was just early within the trend to point out that, hey, this is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, which it did. And so now people look back and think, wow, 2018, I didn't even know how to spell uranium. Mm-hmm. And you're already on the trade. So it makes me look good, but it's because I could see it early enough. Then people started to associate me with uranium, and then I started to speak more about it. And then there's obviously, you know, the fact that I did make good returns with it, et cetera, et cetera. And so one thing just pulled the next thing, but I never actually set out to
have that association,
a uranium focused person. No.
is it one of your favorite resources or?
Yes. Well, what the funny thing about uranium is that the thesis was good back in 2018 when I made that claim, but it has gotten so much better mm-hmm. that I've almost changed I have definitely changed the goalposts of what I expected the market to do. And I'm glad I did because whenever I entered the trade, it was consensus that at $60 per pound, more production was going to come online. And then that would be a point which you start, you know, selling your positions. And 60 meant nothing for me personally, because by then both the supply and the demand pictures had changed so much that I knew it was just going to be a quick pit stop to a much higher number. And so I've never seen a commodity where there is no substitute and buyers are so complacent and they allow all of these financial people to come into their market where they're, you know, the people that should be getting the material are the utilities, not the traders, not the financials. But they allowed all of that to happen because they got too comfortable with a market that was, you know, out of balance in their benefit for so long. And that should never have happened. And because it has happened, it means that we were looking at a thesis from, you know, an even longer term view and thinking, okay, like supply, where's supply going to come from? And we just can't find, you know, good sources of quick supply, which is another matter. You know, it's one thing for us to say, hey, we found this deposit. I mean, NextGen found their uranium deposit. I think it was 2014 or something like that. It was a long time ago. It's been at least 10 years. And, you know, the whole argument is, are they going to be able to produce one single pound of uranium in the 2020s, or is it going to be the 2030s? So the fact that we're finding more of this thing, of this commodity, does not mean that we can produce it. In fact, no, I don't see any government making it easier mm-hmm. to produce or faster. And so it doesn't really matter if the price today is, you know, 80 or 90 or 100 or 120, you can't really find an easy and fast way to increase production on a scale that's big enough to, you know, quench the thirst from China and all of these other countries buying up stock.
And I think that there's also a bit like this sort of, because we're on the topic of uranium, sort of the accidents, I guess, that have happened over the years. People are so skeptical, but I think what's happened now, at least in the last 3 years, because people are starting to realize, well, you could power an entire, you know, five cities the size of New York with a little bit of uranium, right? And it does it in a way that's very clean and cost effective. Well, I don't want to say cost effective yet, but It does it in a way that, you know, it's green energy, literally. Like you,
yes.
So there's this whole like battle on like the cultural level that's like societies going back and forth. But I think, you know, the East has obviously realized that there's not enough of it. Kazakhstan's obviously the big sort of domestic or international supply hub for that region. Russia, Ukraine, obviously being part of that. Canada, I mean, we've got, and the U.S. too. I mean, it's getting interesting. It's just there's all these restrictions I find where it's like it's inhibiting on our ability to actually get it to it faster than we would want. Right.
Yeah, so, I think there's a huge obsession with the green, like the typical renewable stuff. That
what appears to be green, but actually,
yeah,
isn't.
Correct. So that's the thing is, so there's this obsession with burning what they call coal. Renewable and green and stuff. But the thing is, so this is more of my take from like the mechanics of building out an infrastructure is that the oil and natural gas industry to build out our global infrastructure has taken decades to do. But here we are trying to transition out of that infrastructure into this renewable sense from, you know, solar panels to sun. But we're doing it in a way where we're trying to force it and in a fast way, driven by government rather than by the marketplace, that I feel that there's going to be a lot of mistakes and a lot of infrastructure cracks that we're going to reach an inflection point where they're going to have to pivot and say, well, we don't want natural and gas. That's done. We can't, clearly it's not working very well with the traditional renewable solutions. We have no choice but to resolve to kind of fall back on nuclear because it's the only quick kind of solution we'll have to temporarily solve that gap. And it prevents us from going back to oil and gas. And we clearly can't necessarily depend on, like a couple weeks ago we had in Texas, a massive hailstorm that destroyed a massive solar farm.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can't have those type of things happening or else your energy grid is completely out of whack and unreliable.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like these problems are building and an inflection point is coming.
There's a big difference between capacity to generate electricity or energy in general and actual energy output. And I think that's what got lost in translation, probably on purpose by the people who were selling the idea of solar panels and wind generation as well. Because the fact that, you know, something can produce if it's at 100% capacity to, well, by definition, you know, both wind and solar do not generate 100% capacity. Mm-hmm. But the headline numbers are the capacity numbers. So in order to sell it to the population, it's very easy to do so because it looks like you're doing it on the cheap. Mm-hmm. And when we get to a certain level, I find of, I guess, economic wealth, we value what's new way more than what's old, and it almost doesn't matter that the new stuff isn't proven quite yet. And so whenever solar panels and, you know, windmills started to catch on, you know, the West was pretty rich. Like, we were doing fine, and we just wanted better, cleaner ways of generating energy. If you're thinking of a cleaner way to generate something that is absolutely necessary for human survival, it's because you're at a level of comfort, right? You're not doing just the bare minimum. Now, the East takes a look at this from a completely different perspective. There, you have India, you have China, you have all these countries with massive population growth or economic growth in the case of China, which isn't growing as much population-wise, but, you know, they are growing in wealth. And they're thinking, where in the world are we going to get energy from? Well, from everything. Let's go into nuclear, let's go into coal, let's go into solar, knowing that the solar isn't going to do the job and that wind power isn't going to do the job. But let's have a mix, but let's double down on everything so that the population can have access to energy, whether it's clean or not. We'll cross that bridge when we get to it, but people need energy to survive. They need to be able to get to the bare basics. So I think that way of thinking has made the East cleaner because they're going more for nuclear energy without, you know, the I guess, the influence of this whole fight of, you know, green thinking versus
correct
good old
I think there's
energy.
Too much of that game that in the West, that they want to create this perfect illusion that the green solution they have in mind is ideal. But then you have a scenario like, again, the farm, and then another one was like in Scotland, there's this whole scandal of how this this wind farm was using diesel to generate the turbine movement because there was not enough wind, you
in
know.
Scotland?
So in wow. Scotland, so
if
there
you
is
can't
so
make wind work in Scotland, let me tell you, give up.
You know, so it's like it's because it's such a political game and the political system is so intertwined with this movement that this mirage and this illusion has to be maintained. And I think in the West, it's going to come at the cost of the middle class and the majority of people, where there's this new concept coming out where you have energy poverty, where we will create energy poverty because we think that, you know, just switching the grid to another system is just as simple as snapping our fingers. No, it's a complicated process, and nuclear would be such an incredible add-on to the mixed of a system, but it's not even open to a discussion, or at least it appears not to be in the West.
Yes, so. And I think it's a lot more serious than we talk about, because we look at it from an investing and an economic fact, mm-hmm. but what's happening is that people are dying,
yeah,
because of these decisions. You know, there are zero countries in the world today and historically that are low in energy production or consumption and high in wealth. That is a very tight correlation, because you absolutely need more energy in order to be more productive, in order to create more wealth. And so what world leaders don't realize is that their irresponsible ways of dealing with the energy mix has definitely made people poorer, and poverty kills people. So it's very serious.
I want to add more on a positive note, but I do agree with that. I mean, you know, not to get political here, but, you know, Trump ran his campaign on energy independence. And when he was in office, like, they were incredibly, everything was cheaper, right? Same thing under Harper, because he understood you need oil and gas. You need mining too. Canada is probably the richest mining country in the world. There's no question about that. It's just there's all this bureaucratic red tape and whatnot. But and by the way, for the listeners, you sit on the board of Rush Rare Metals, I believe, right? On the CSE, yes. Is that correct? Yeah.
Yes.
So really, to wrap up, I mean, there's a lot that's going to happen in the next several years, especially as a contrarian. But anybody that's really new to this space, and I know you're about to welcome a newborn as well, but what type of values and what type of thinking would you, or advice would you give to people that are just getting started as really becoming a contrarian?
I would say understand and develop your edge more than anything. If you are just very much a technical person, whether that's technical analysis, engineering, or geology, I know, you know, we talked it down whenever we started this, because it's like, I am not good at that. That's not my skill set. If you do have the skill set, double, triple, quadruple down on that. I look at massive amounts of people and social movements, and that's where I have an edge. I think the fact that I'm a woman actually makes me a little bit better at that, because I can take a look at a room full of people and kind of have a feel for the room. And I know what some people are thinking, and, you know, what their beliefs are by the way that they're acting, et cetera. And so observing a lot of people and the way that they're acting and going back and forth, that I personally can capitalize on, but maybe your edge is something completely different. So in order, I mean, more so than wanting the title of being called a contrarian, it's important to understand what can you be a little bit better at than the average person. That's really the only question that you should be asking yourself when you're starting out. And I mean, risk management, especially when I'm talking to guys, risk management. I know that you've just found a company. It's a hot tip by a guy, you know, who really talks a good game, and you think it's going to be like the next big thing. But hold your horses. Don't go all in on anything, not even your own deals, because anything that can happen in mining does happen in mining.
So it's really about not putting your eggs into one basket, essentially, because I've heard the horror stories.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you could literally be about to pour gold and your license be taken away from you.
Yeah.
So.
Well, Robert Kiyosaki has a good story. He says that he had a gold mine in China that got taken away from him. Yep. You know, so geopolitics. Yeah.
Babby, this has been a very interesting conversation. I know you've got a pretty busy couple of weeks here coming up, so we want to wish you good luck and early congratulations, because it's such an awesome thing to obviously be a part of. But where can the listeners find you?
Thank you. So people can find me under the name The Next Big Rush, pretty much anywhere, whether that's YouTube, thenextbigrush.com is the newsletter. And I can also be found on X.com, formerly known as Twitter.
Awesome.
That's awesome. So yeah, subscribe to her newsletter and subscribe to our newsletter. We still have a long way to go before we catch Fabi, but again, really appreciate you coming on and kind of sharing your insights, and especially finding a multi-bagger. That's always an interesting story to hear from.
Yeah, I have a few of those, but yeah, be happy to come back some other time and share more about how to find multi-baggers, because there are quite a few different ways of doing it, for sure.
You're welcome back anytime.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right, guys. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time on the New Gen Mindset Podcast.
Ciao, guys. Take care.